The following is an encore episode of Hour One of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Turley Frequency with Kevin Turley, a show for you and by you. The phone lines are open, so call now at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881, and share with us your thoughts and prayer intentions as we navigate this complicated world together. And now, your host of the Turley Frequency, Kevin Turley.
Hello and welcome to the Turley Frequency with me, your host, Kevin Turley, coming to you live from London. Yes, through the wonders of the internet, we are able to spend time together, you in Alabama or wherever you happen to be listening on the app or streaming us throughout the world, and me sat here in a rather sunny and pleasant London. How are you this Friday, the November the 11th, in the year of our Lord 2022? Now, as you, many of you will know, this is Veterans Day in the United States. It's called Armistice Day over here. It's a day when many nations remember the conflicts of old and those who have served their nations in those conflicts. And we think especially of those who have died during the two world wars of the last century. Their sacrifice is particularly remembered and acknowledged by the nations that they fought for. For many, no doubt, it is a somber day. And if you're a veteran listening to this, then we'd love to hear from you. If you want to chime in at any point on 888-928-0881 or text us on 251-928-2111. I was out at Mass this morning and I was walking back and I was a bit distracted. I had to go off and do bits and bobs and I was coming back. And as I was walking along, it was a busy London street, lots of people around, shopping, moving about, cars, travel, all the rest of it. And I was distracted and I noticed out of the corner of my eye, in the corner of a road, one of the major roads, four elderly gentlemen. And they were stood there with their heads bowed. And I suppose it immediately dawned on me. I looked at my watch and realized it was 11 o'clock. And 11 o'clock is the hour in this country. I'm sure it's different in different parts of the world, but it's 11 o'clock here when people stop, pause, and remember the dead. And it was kind of a touching ensemble because it was a group of men of quite diverse backgrounds. Some were obviously not Christian. One of them was wearing a turban, and I've seen him around. I think he may even live not far from me, and he's a Sikh. I know that. So it was very touching to see this group of elderly men with their heads bowed, standing silently on a street. But I have to say that the rest of the world, including myself, were busy about our business and not really thinking of that sacrifice. Which leads me to think a little bit about how we've arrived at where we're at in terms of remembering wars and the sacrifices made during them. Now, as many of you will know, the reason why today in particular has become associated with veterans and the armistice is that at the end of the First World War, at the 11th hour on the 11th day of the 11th month, the guns fell silent on the Western Front. And the great carnage of that war ceased after 4 years. From 1914 to 1918, there was a world war. I think America entered it in 1917. My great-grandfather, for example, was one of the first to be called up. And it was fascinating reading war diaries, which involved his battalion, as he was very, very quickly taken from civilian life to the Western Front. But what struck me today when I was looking at those men was the modern world, and in particular the secular modern world, doesn't do remembrance or suffering very well. Let me explain what I mean by that. In 1918, when the war ended in Great Britain, the United Kingdom, Britain as it was then, the four constituent parts of England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales, were Christian countries. Now, they were nominally Christian, perhaps. I mean, people still went to church. The state was officially a Protestant country, in a sense. The monarch was Protestant, and in different parts of that realm, there was what's known as the state religion. It still is today in England. The state religion is Anglicanism, which is separated from Rome. Therefore, in Catholic eyes, it's Protestant. Some Anglicans would argue the toss about that, but that's the state of play, really. But even in a nominally Protestant country, there was an idea of prayers and remembrance. However, what people tend to forget is that since the English Reformation in these islands, and indeed the Reformation across Europe, the idea of praying for the dead has been almost exclusively a Catholic phenomenon. We Catholics think nothing of praying for the dead. Have masses said for them, pray the rosary for them. We visit graveyards. We have indulgences even in this great month of November. We have a month dedicated to remembering the holy souls, as we say, the souls in purgatory. But you've got to remember that one of the great smash and grabs of the reformers was to take purgatory out of the equation, to remove it altogether. And when they did that, they also removed, in essence, the need to pray for the dead. So the way in which the Protestant state initially, or Protestant states, I should say, remembered their dead was slightly different to the way that Catholics would, and maybe Catholic nations. Because we don't remember our dead in a kind of vacuum. We don't think simply of the loss of those that have gone before us. We still feel connected with them. We still feel very much part of their lives, and they are very much part of ours. Why? Because we believe in the church, not just in this realm, but the church suffering and the church being purified in the realm of purgatory. That's what the word purgatory means, purification. But it's also a kind of happy suffering because it's en route to our eternal home, which is heaven. But the secular world doesn't in any way view that. So the Protestantism of the past, certainly in this country, and I would suggest to an extent in the United States, has decreased. And what has been replaced with is a dominant secular ideology, which basically says that all religions are the same and all are of little consequence to the modern world. And as was said to me once in a meeting at work, you can be any religion you want as long as you keep it to yourself. That in some ways sums up the modern view of religion, certainly in this country, and I suspect in great swathes of the United States, perhaps less so in Alabama and other places where religion still plays a part in people's lives. So when the secular world starts to remember the war dead in the way that it does today, it can often feel that it is not fully conversant with what we Catholics are remembering. I was listening to Todd and Ellen before we came on air, and they were talking about different things. And one of the things that struck me or came to me was that sometimes when people are remembering Veterans Day or Armistice Day, they certainly hear in the media here, it turns into a remembrance of war. And inevitably, if you turn on a radio, you'd end a talk radio show, you end up with a debate about war and peace. The veterans get lost somewhere in the middle, and you end up with ideologies battling it out as to whether we should have wars, whether we shouldn't have wars. And I would say that this is because the view of what we're doing today on the 11th of November is deficient. Today we are remembering the dead. Throughout this month, we are remembering the dead. And we're not just remembering them in some way that you would remember, oh yes, I went and did that so many years ago. No, we're remembering them in prayer. That's what we Catholics are doing. It really makes me, well, it doesn't make me laugh. It makes me rather sad that many affirmed atheist in social media and such like, whenever a tragedy happens, like a bombing outrage or a natural disaster hits a country, people will say that you're in our thoughts and in our prayers, or you're in our thoughts. And with the greatest of respect, what good is it for me to be in your thoughts when there's a catastrophe of some sort hitting me or those that I love? I need prayers. We need prayers. And the souls of those that have fallen in the world wars, they need prayers. And perhaps our veterans today also need prayers because of all the side effects and long-term effects of serving in battle zones. And if you want to call in and tell me about that, 888-928-0881, or feel free to text in on 251-928-2111. Prayer is something which is dynamic, effective. It is not simply a remembrance. It is something much, much more important and much more effective than just that. So the business of the secular state's remembrance of conflicts past leaves me a little bit cold. And as I say, this has got nothing to do with veterans, nothing to do with the sacrifice, the bravery of those that have served and have fought against tyranny of one sort or another. It's got nothing to do with that. But I'm afraid it's the idea of what it is that people are serving and sacrificing. Remember, G.K. Chesterton said that the real Christian soldier doesn't fight the enemy in front of him. He doesn't fight the enemy in front of him. He fights for those that he loves that are behind him. He fights for those that he loves behind him, or who he loves behind him. But he loves his country. And he loves his family, and he loves his way of life, and that's what he's fighting for. He's not fighting an enemy. I think at the end of the day, it's only that Catholic vision of living and dying that satisfies my mind and my heart. But still today we pray for the dead because we believe in the idea of judgment. It's very unfashionable. We also believe in particular in the idea of the final judgment. But then that leads us also to some other extremely unfashionable conclusions. Because if there's a judgment, that means that there is a choice. And it's not a choice that we make, or in a sense it is. We are making that choice throughout our lives. But there's a choice of destination, shall we say, about where we end up once we die. There are a number of words that have been excised from the English language in the last 20 or 30 years, maybe longer. One is sin. Nobody talks about sin anymore. Yes, some priests talk about it. I'm not for a moment suggesting that. Some brave priests will preach on it on a Sunday. But it's not a word you hear talked about, that something is sinful. Something is, people won't even say things are wrong these days. The other word, which is extremely unfashionable, is hell. People talk about heaven all the time. They talk about heavenly delights. They talk about so-and-so's gone to heaven. We'll all meet again in heaven. It runs off the tongue just a little bit too glibly sometimes. Hell exists. And that's why we need prayer. That's why we must pray for the holy souls. They're in danger. We have to pray for them. Now, once a holy soul is in purgatory, they are on their way to heaven. That is theologically what the church teaches and what we accept. But in this life, we need to understand that our actions have consequences. Unrepented sin is unrepented sin. Now, we pray. And we beg for the hope and beg and hope for the mercy of God. And at the top of the next hour, we'll be praying the divine mercy, specifically begging for the mercy of God for the living and the dead. But I think it's important to be reminded of these things on a day which is so given to a public expression of remembrance. But it's very important to remember as Catholics what it is we're remembering and why. Now, speaking of Catholics and speaking of going to Mass this morning, today is the feast of St. Martin de Tours, St. Martin of Tours. Is it any coincidence that it is today, this day, which in modern times has become synonymous with soldiers and their sacrifice, is dedicated to a soldier and a particular sacrifice? You see, Martin was a Roman soldier. In fact, I think, from what I've read, he was a cavalryman. And he made a sacrifice. But it wasn't the ultimate sacrifice that we are remembering today for so many people. It's a different type of sacrifice. You see, one night, he was riding along on his horse, and he saw a beggar. It was a freezing cold night, and the beggar had no cloak. So Martin got off his horse, cut his cloak in half, and gave half to the poor beggar. This is an image which has been, if you go into many churches, you will see this image. And it was very, very popular in the Middle Ages. And I'll come back to how it maybe has fallen out of popularity. But St. Martin's sacrifice, at the time, he wasn't a Christian. I think he was on his way to being a Christian, but he wasn't yet a Christian. But that night, he had a dream. And he had a vision within the dream. And that vision was of our Lord, our risen Lord. And he was wearing Martin's cloak. And what we can tell from that is that Martin was not simply clothing the naked. He was actually doing what the gospel said. And you did it to the least of my brethren, you did it to me. And he did it to our Lord. Now, after that, and this is the bit that people forget. Most people will know that, and most of you listening will have heard that story, I suspect. But what happens next is equally of interest, because Martin then went on to become a Christian, and he ended up a bishop, Bishop of Tours. But his was not some sort of happy life where he sat reading the scriptures and looking after his flock. He was very much involved with the battles that ensued at the time within the church. Arianism was rife, which was then a heresy, which denied the divinity of our Lord. And he was very much involved in that, and very much an active bishop for the people of Tours, which is in modern day France. So Martin has a significance to today because it's the Veterans Day and Armistice Day, and he was a soldier. But he also has a significance for all Christians today that have to battle on many different fronts for the truths of our faith. And that's a battle which will continue until that final judgment, till that final judgment comes. Now, one of the interesting things about St. Martin was how popular he was, certainly in the German-speaking regions, but throughout Europe prior to the so-called Reformation. He was a huge saint, very, very popular here in the British Isles, in Ireland, in England, in Scotland, but especially so in the German-speaking countries. Martin Mass was the celebration. And it was a huge celebration because it came at the end of the octave to do with All Hallowtide. And it was to do with feasting, with beer and with wine and with eating goose. So it has a certain vague premonition to what comes with the American Thanksgiving, for example. But did you know that these Martin Mass celebrations began at the 11th minute of the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month? That's right. They began on the 11th of November at the 11th minute, 11th hour, 11th day. Precisely the moment when the guns fell silent across Europe. I like to think that there is nothing without coincidence. And certainly John Paul II said that in the spiritual realm, there was nothing without coincidence. And I like to see a very Catholic ending to a very hideous conflict, which was the First World War. Now, In the final segment of today's program, I'm going to be talking about a military chaplain who was caught up in that first war and led a very saintly, very heroic, and very priestly life, which culminated in a great sacrifice on the Western Front in 1917. But before that, we will have the chaplet at the top of the hour, and do feel free to phone in during that on 888-928-0881. But next, we're talking folklore, and we are going to be talking Alabama folklore. And that's coming up next here on the Turley Frequency, live on Archangel Radio.
Welcome back to the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. The phone lines are open, so call now at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. And share with us your thoughts and prayer intentions as we navigate this complicated world together. And now, your host of the Turley Frequency, Kevin Turley.
Yes, welcome back to the Turley Frequency with me, your host, Kevin Turley. Now, after a rather somber start, and we will return to the ideas of praying for the dead and also the great sacrifices of the war later in the show, we're just going to change gears a little bit. It's Friday, after all, and we like a little bit of something different on a Friday. And I have to say, I'm delighted to be joined by Emily Blavos, who is the executive director of the Alabama Folklife Association. Emily, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, I was looking at some of your writings and your website earlier, and I was absolutely fascinated by it. Can I come straight out, Emily, and say that having grown up in Ireland, I'm well aware of folklore. Okay, we're it comes with our mother's milk, so to speak. But I was really surprised to find that Alabama seems to be a home from home. It's full of folklore, right?
That's true. And I think what's interesting is, you know, like you say, when you think of Ireland, I think folklore really does come right to mind. But every place is full of folklore. When you think about it, you know, we think about folklife as traditions that get passed down through the generations. And so that is a really broad idea. It's music, it's dance, it's storytelling, it's recipes. It's, you know, in Alabama, especially, it's fishing traditions, hunting traditions. We have a lot of nature traditions, you know, gardening and all of it. So,
Let's just start with that, Emily, because I've got a list of questions here for you. Don't worry. But my first question is really the definition of folklore, because it can be everything from fairy tales to ghost stories, but it can also be a whole range of other things. Now, I know that in your association, it's a historical program as much as anything else. So help me out here. Give me the beginner's guide to what is folklore.
Yeah, well, I think it is kind of a nebulous concept, but we think about it as traditions that get passed down through the generations. And so a lot of times you'll think about, you know, folk art, which can be passed down, but can also not be. So we think about those things that you get through your family or through your community that has been handed down to you. And that can also actually be through work life, too. You know, there's a lot of folk life that goes along with, like, when you think about railroad, work songs, that kind of thing. So that's sort of at the core of it for me.
So it's everything and nothing in a sense, Emily, isn't it? It's everything around us and everything that's been around us and been around our parents, our grandparents, our great grandparents. Is that a way of sort of summing it up? The culture, the life, the sounds, the smells, the food, even.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. It is all around us, and I think what's fun and interesting and important about folk life is that it's sort of what makes us who we are. I mean, it's really intrinsic to our identities, and it's what makes a place different than another place too. It's what makes Ireland different than Alabama and different than California. And, you know, these are the things that really sort of define us as people and as places.
Well, talk to me about that, Emily, because if you were to ask me about Irish folklore, I could go off on a tangent. But specifically Alabama, like I arrive and meet you in Mobile in the high street. We sit down, we have a cup of coffee together, and I say to you, Emily, what is Alabama folklore? What is its essence? Talk to me about it. What would you say?
Yeah, I would say, you know, well, what I'm trying to do, one thing that I'm trying to do with at the Folklife Association is really pay homage to that quintessential Alabama folk traditions, like quilting is huge in Alabama, pottery, basket making, also storytelling, ghost stories. Alabamians love ghost stories. I guess we have that in common with our Irish.
We certainly do.
colleagues. but it's also recipes, you know, but there's also, you know, a lot of indigenous traditions that we haven't been as good about recognizing. There are immigrant traditions. So, you know, making pinatas is Alabama folk life. Finger weaving is Alabama folk life. It's, you know, I'm trying to really be, to really elevate all kinds of different cultures and different practices that we have within our borders. Because the thing about Alabama that I think people overlook, especially, you know, who aren't familiar with Alabama, is its diversity. We have so much diversity within our borders, you know, culturally, geographically, historically. And so that's exciting as the director of this kind of organization. I will never run out of things to talk about. So we just did a podcast called Alabama Folk, and we did 6 episodes, and those traditions that we talk about are so different from each other, but they're all within the borders of Alabama.
Well, I guess that's maybe if you were to throw the question back at me, Emily, in terms of Ireland and Alabama, the difference as I would see it is that Ireland has a sort of more homogenous, certainly in the last few centuries, culture and things that you can sort of pick up on. Whereas I get the impression from the little I'm learning about Alabama, I'm learning at a rapid pace, but it's a much more diverse history than it's as diverse as any other part of the United States. In the sense that it is lots of comings and goings and peoples and foods and the ways of living that all sort of come together in a geographic area. Is that a fair summation, that it's a story which is still developing in a sense?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm so glad that you said that, because I think a lot of time when people hear folk life or folklore or folk ways, they think about something that's sort of trapped in time or old timey,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
And that's not what we think about at all. You know, folk life is constantly evolving. I mean, all life is change, right? So there's always, you know, new people sort of leaving their personality. Even if you're practicing a tradition that's been in your family for 7 generations, you're still going to leave your mark, you know. And then, of course, like you said, we have new cultures coming in, new ways of doing things. The environment is changing also. And so that will affect folk life. Like, for instance, it's harder for white oak basket makers to find white oak, you know, that kind of stuff. So folk life is always in flux, definitely.
Yes, and I guess, I mean, the only thing I would say to that, though, Emily, and I'd love your take on this, is there a danger, though, that we expand the sort of definition so wide that it takes in everything? And you and I will both know that a lot of modern culture is very, very samey, whether it's London, whether it's Mobile, it's the same restaurants, it's the same food chains, it's the same television shows, the same music. Do you know what I mean? There's a danger that culture just becomes so mainstream and so generated in a way that it loses any individuality or any kind of geographic location. So is there an element in your work where you're having to define, actually, that is not part of Alabama folk life? That is generic and far too samey.
That's really interesting. I guess because we keep at our core those traditions that are getting handed down, I don't really have to push against that much. I mean, I think... you know, the things that we do that our parents and our grandparents did, just tend not to fall into that category of being generic. You know, folk life is almost the reverse side of that coin, because it's those things that we're doing that not everybody else is doing, you know, those things that are making us unique. So I don't see much of a danger of that. I think, you know, when you're cooking something that your grandmother used to cook, or your, like my husband's family is Polish, and so we chalk the lintel of the door, you know, on Three Kings uh-huh. Day, and we do a płocek on Christmas Eve. So those are the things that are kind of, you know, making our lives unique, the exact opposite of sort of this mass culture. But that's a tricky question, because, you know, you do want to be, folk life is changing and it is adaptable too. So we're seeing, you know, there's a lot of folklorists talking about, you know, TikTok videos like that. That's a particular representation of a culture that's, you know, happening right now. So we don't want to get sort of dig in and get stuck in our ways either. So yeah, it is, it's an interesting question, an interesting balance.
Now, I would imagine as well that in Alabama, you're going to have, it's a very ethnically diverse region. So you're going to have folklore cultures that, you know, lots of very distinctive cultures. So, I mean, in a way, how do you kind of put that all under the umbrella of Alabama, as opposed to silos of this culture, this culture, this culture?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what we do is make sure that when we have an annual journal that we publish, and like mm-hmm. I said, we just started our podcast. So we just make sure that we're representative. So those six episodes of the podcast are from different cultures. Both men and women are speaking. So each episode is on a different tradition and has an interview with either a tradition bearer or a traditional artist or maker. And they come from different cultures, and their art forms are also diverse. So, you know, one person is making soap, one person is cooking, one person is doing traditional dance. And so I think they stand alone individually as stories, but as a collective, they're sort of showcasing all of what Alabama has, you know, within its borders.
Now, as you know, this is a Catholic radio station, Emily, and I was wondering, in terms of folk life, what distinctive Catholic traditions or would you see, or have you come across in your researches in Alabaman history and culture?
There are so many. I actually was just at the American Folklore Society meeting, so that's where all the folklorists get together.
Wonderful.
And there's a whole piece of study of religious folklore, and especially Catholic, when you think about all of the folk traditions that go along with Latin America versus Poland versus, I mean,
that's
Catholicism
true.
Is around the world. And you think about, I'm thinking about, you know, bringing the basket to Easter in the Polish tradition, but also All Souls Day, all the Day of the Dead stuff in mm-hmm. Mexico and Latin America. There's so much.
Yeah. And probably as well some of the cuisine, you know, the way Catholic dietary rules about, you know, Lent or eating on Fridays, fish on Fridays. Has that influenced some of the food?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a great cross, sort of a crossover or blending of religious folk life. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're not eating meat on Fridays, or fish on Fridays, or the fish fries, you know, all of that is folk life. That's all stuff that gets passed down in our families and communities and religious communities as well.
Great. You're listening to Emily Blavos, who is the executive director of the Alabama Folklife Association. And she's speaking to me, Kevin Turley, here on the Turley Frequency live on Archangel Radio. You do realize I'm in London, Emily, don't you?
Yes.
The wonders of technology that we've ended up like
I
this.
Know. Now, it sounds like you're right next door.
Emily, are you able to stay for the next segment, take some questions if we have any, or any sort of written questions, comments that come in?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so if you want to have a word with Emily about anything sort of folk life related to do with Alabama, then call us on 888-928-0881 or text in a question. I'm very happy to field them for you on 251-928-2111. And, I mean, I've got one question, though, Emily. How do you end up getting into this? I mean, I'm taking from your accent you're maybe not originally from Alabama.
That's right. I grew up in Minnesota, and I've lived in Alabama since 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a great question. So I wrote a book called The Story of Alabama in 14 Foods.
I know, so I want to talk to you about that, but probably in the next segment.
Yeah, that's how I got sort of pulled into the Folklife Association originally, and I served on the board and then became the director a couple of years ago. But I've just always been interested in culture. I was actually a religion major in college and studied anthropology and sociology in grad school, and I'm just interested in people and culture and what they do, and folk life is sort of, like we said, a big catch-all for all of that cultural stuff.
So listen, if anybody has any questions for Emily, or any, presumably you're open to any stories as well, Emily, you know, or suggestions for areas of investigation.
Sure.
By your association. Yes. I mean, we may be able to uncover certain historical or cultural aspects of Alabama through this radio show that are as yet unknown to the Alabama Folklife Association. Who knows?
Exactly.
You never know. It's Friday.
Exactly. Yes, we're always looking for those ideas.
Okay, listen, we're going to keep Emily with us for the next segment, and if you want to call in, do so. Okay, back after these words.
Welcome back to the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. The phone lines are open, so call now at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. And share with us your thoughts and prayer intentions as we navigate this complicated world together. And now, your host of the Turley Frequency, Kevin Turley.
Yes, welcome back to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. And we have managed to keep Emily Blavos, who is the executive director of the Alabama Folklife Association, with us for another few minutes. So if you want to speak to her about all matters folklife and Alabama, then do feel free to call in on 888-928-0881 or text me, and I'm happy to field your questions on 251-928-2111. Now, Emily, you have written a book called The Story of Alabama in 14 Foods.
That's right. That's right. And go ahead.
I'm very interested in the story of Alabama. And if there's a way of combining that with 14 foods and having a nice nosh up as well, a nice feed, then I'm very happy to hear all about it. So talk me through this. Well, how can you tell the story of a state through food?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that it is really a history and culture book. So the idea was to tell the story of Alabama through the lens of foodways. So each chapter is a different food, and it uses that history of that food or stories about that food to tell a particular Alabama story. So we have a chapter on corn that talks about Native American history in Alabama, particularly Creek history. And we have gumbo, which talks about Creoles and Creoles of color on the Gulf Coast. And particularly Mardi Gras. Gumbo is central to the African American and Creole Mardi Gras traditions. That's a whole bucket of folk life in itself. And then there's a chapter about Lane Cake that talks about women's history in Alabama. So it just kind of goes on like that. So each chapter is used to sort of tell a piece of Alabama history. And I try to lay it out chronologically. There's a ton of overlap, obviously. But I try to touch on all the different geographies we have in Alabama. We go from the Gulf Coast to the foothills of the Appalachians. So it's a really wide range. We have a ton of biodiversity. It's just a real mix.
So talk to me a little bit about the Gulf Coast in particular, Mobile, Fairhope. What foodstuffs did you identify there as telling the story?
Yeah, we had gumbo for sure. I don't
forgive my ignorance. What is gumbo? Sorry.
Yeah, so gumbo is a stew, and on the Gulf Coast, it's usually a seafood stew, and it's traditionally made, of course, with fresh seafood from the coast, and then just sort of scraps of whatever you had tossed in there. So, you know, it's a really versatile dish. Every gumbo cook makes a different gumbo, and no gumbo tastes the same. So it's got, you know, vegetables and seafood. Some people will make it with chicken, but it's a long, slow simmering stew. What I love about it is that it pulls in ingredients from all different places, and so it's got African ingredients, native ingredients, and European ingredients, and that's sort of the definition of Southern food, is that it was this mixing and melding of those three cultures, you know, the native, the African, and the European cultures coming together and sort of influencing each other. And so that's why I feel like gumbo is such a good representation of Alabama traditions, especially coastal traditions, because it was that mix. You know, Mobile was a Spanish city. It was a French city. It's an old city with a long sort of history of mixing. And so gumbo is a perfect food to tell that story.
Now, we have a question that's been texted in, Emily, from a listener. They are saying, we are wondering if Emily has a favorite folk tradition in Alabama or one that is really unique.
Oh, that's so interesting. Gosh, there are so many to choose from.
Well, give us a few. You don't have to have to one, but give us a few of your favorites that have really stuck with you over the years.
Yeah, well, I mean, living in Mobile, I have to say Mardi Gras. And in particular, so we have a local, you know, Mobile is always sort of has a chip on its shoulder about New Orleans Mardi Gras because everyone thinks about New Orleans, but Mobile was first. Mm-hmm. And our Mardi Gras is different. It's very family friendly. It's really about sort of community. But one tradition that I love in Mobile is we have something called Joe Kane Day. Joe Kane was the guy who rebooted and restarted Mardi Gras after the Civil War. So he sort of brought, you know, the Mardi Gras parades back to Mobile after the suffering of the Civil War. And so we celebrate him on the Sunday before Mardi Gras. And there's a whole group of women who call themselves the Joe Kane Mary Widows. And they dress in black and they arrive at the cemetery where he's buried, sort of wailing and going through this, you know, grief process. And no one's allowed into the cemetery, but we all sit on the walls, you know, to watch. And they go in and they go to his grave and they're weeping. And then one of them says, you know, but Joe would want us to be happy. And this is a whole performance, of course, you know. And the membership in the society gets handed down through from mother to daughter a lot of times, too. So it sort of stays in this group. And so then they start saying, you know, so then they start just whooping and throwing beads and to the crowd. And the mood just changes instantaneously. And they decided they're going to celebrate, you know, and it's just it's so strange and so different. I've seen it a couple times and, I'm just sort of blown away by it every time.
Now, while preparing for this interview, Emily, I did a little bit of what we all do, quick internet search, and I was really shocked to find the word leprechaun and Alabama together. Are you familiar with this phenomena?
Yes, that is that's another Mobile folk life tradition, and I don't mean to focus on Mobile, but I do live in Mobile, so I'm
more familiar. We're very happy for you to focus on Mobile.
So the leprechaun, the best thing to do really is to watch the original news clip, which you can find on YouTube. But there's a community in Mobile called Crichton. It's a neighborhood of Mobile. And there was just this sort of spotting of a leprechaun in a tree, and it just sort of grew and everybody was out there looking for it. And then they did a news clip about it. And the news clip is just really hilarious. Someone did an amateur sketch of a leprechaun and holds it up. And it's just become this beloved sort of piece of history for us. And so now there's like the amateur sketch of the Crichton leprechaun. You can get like t-shirts and people just, you know, every St. Patrick's Day, the video is posted. And yeah, it's just sort of like it's the Crichton leprechaun is sort of our folk hero down here, I guess. That's something that's popped up new too. I mean, that's only been maybe 15 years, so that's a newer folk tradition.
Absolutely. I was very pleased in a sense to see the leprechaun had managed to swim the ocean and turned up. But I have to say, Emily, I found myself, shall we say, a little bit suspicious that his appearance was timed so beautifully on St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, isn't that strange, you know?
Isn't it strange? curious. So, listen, what about another one that caught my attention? What about, have you heard of this Eliza Battle, this ghostly steamship? Have you heard of this?
Yes, I have. Yes. So we have a book in Alabama called 13 Alabama Ghosts and Jeffrey. And it's by a woman called Catherine Tucker Windham. She was a really beloved storyteller and historian in Alabama. And this book has just deep significance for a lot of Alabamians who remember reading it as children. I've been told several times that the hold list at the local library was just dozens of people long. You know, if you didn't have your own copy, you just waited and waited for your turn to read it. It came out in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so it's these 14 ghost stories. And the Eliza Battle was a steamship that caught on fire on the Tombigbee River. And people still report sort of seeing the outline of the ship. And there are actually several Alabama ghost stories that have to do with ships. But that was not an uncommon occurrence for steamships in the 1800s. It was a very dangerous profession and, you know, mode of transportation. They were heavy and they were really unsafe. So people still say they can sort of see the outline of the ship on the river. But Alabamians, like I said before, they love ghost stories. Maybe everybody does.
I don't think everybody does. My wife is English, not Irish, and I don't think she likes ghost stories at all. Whereas I think the Irish have a propensity to ghost stories. Because, as you know, Halloween started in Ireland, and it was basically telling a ghost story around the fire, you know, and it was some sort of strange occurrence, you know, that sort of idea. So, no, we love a good old ghost story. But, I mean, on a more serious point, Emily, there has to be an academic differentiation between what is, you know, a good yarn that people like to tell in a tavern as opposed to something which has credibility of some sort, you know. Would the Crichton leprechaun or Eliza Battle really be seriously considered as part of the story of Alabama, the folklore of Alabama?
Yes, because folk life for us is not about whether it's true. Or figuring out, you know, did this really, you know, are you really seeing this? That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in what people do and the culture that surrounds those people and how they sort of tell stories and live their lives. And so we look at that sort of those cultural acts and those, you know, pieces of material culture that represent sort of what people do. So the fact that these stories get handed down is interesting to us, you know, in folk life. So just the story itself and the way that it gets passed down, that's the part that we're really interested in versus sort of trying to pull it apart or dig into it or decide, you know, whether it has merit. That's, you know, we'll leave that to others.
So in some ways, it's a celebration of life in Alabama, past, present, and possibly future.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to think about it.
Now, you're not from Alabama. Does that give you a particular, a sort of a better eye to judge some of these traditions because you're actually one step maybe removed from all of the cultures that swirl around Alabama?
I think it gives me an advantage and a disadvantage. I think not being from Alabama, I don't think I can ever truly understand, what it means to grow up in Alabama. But I think the good thing about it is that I recognize immediately sort of the pieces of Alabama culture that are different and significant. So when you grow up in a place, you just think that's how it is just because, everybody's that way. And so a lot of times there'll be something about Alabama that I recognize as different from other places that Alabamians would just take for granted, So in that way, it does help and it does give me an edge. But, I've met people that have lived in Alabama for 30 years and they still don't consider themselves an Alabamian. It's the kind of thing where, if you don't grow up here, I think there is a, you will sort of always be one step removed. That's the sense I get.
That's a very interesting, because we on this side of the Atlantic, we tend to think that the United States, people just drift in and drift out of cultures and places, and there's not the same sort of fixed nature that you have over here. But it sounds to me maybe Alabama is a place which has a very clear sense of who they are and who is who.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are a lot of, like any place, there are a lot of families who have lived here for generations. But then, of course, there's flux and there's change as well. And I have to say, too, that Alabama is a very warm place to live. Obviously, I'm not from here. You can hear my accent, but I've been interviewing probably 100 or more people in Alabama over the past, decades that I've lived here. And everyone has been so welcoming and gracious, happy to share their experiences with me, just open. I find Alabama to be a really kind of permeable place. People are willing to talk to you. They're willing to share. I've really never had the experience where someone's, closed off. And so that's really exciting. And my family is originally from the South. My grandmother actually grew up not far from Mobile in Mississippi, just over the border. And so I was always familiar with the South as a place. Mm-hmm. It wasn't totally foreign to me. But definitely living here is a different experience than growing up in Minnesota.
Well, you're doing a very good job, Emily, at selling it to me. You've really whetted my appetite to visit Alabama and learn more about it. Where can people find out more about you and your books, etc.?
Yeah, so the Alabama Folklife Association, our website is alabamafolklife.org, and that has all kinds of things about our programs. We're, like I mentioned before, really excited about our new podcast, Alabama Folk. We just released season one this fall, and you'll see all kinds of things. And like you said before the break, we are always looking for new traditions and new tradition bearers and makers and traditional artists. I'm just one person, and so I really rely on people to sort of come out of the woodwork and tell me about their traditions, and I'm always interested to hear from people. So I would really encourage anyone listening in Alabama to reach out and get involved.
And what's the name of the podcast again, Emily?
It's called Alabama Folk, and you can find it wherever you listen. Yeah.
Okay. Listen, Emily, it's been great fun speaking to you. I've really enjoyed having you on the show. I hope you'll come back again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it as well.
Okay. That's Emily Blavos, Executive Director of the Alabama Folklife Association. When we come back, we're going to do some praying and the Divine Mercy coming up next here on Archangel Radio.